Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Niler 9 podcast on episode 220. It is a chat with the author and journalist Michael Craig, who writes for The Guardian and other publications. He has a book out at the moment called Reach for the Stars, which I got on the way to my holidays recently. And it is, I just absolutely loved it. It was the book that explores and celebrates it's and contextualizes the period of UK pop that flourished between 1996 and 2006 through an oral history book. Andrea Cleary is here, of course. How are you, Andrea?
Hey, I'm good.
You've enjoyed reading this book.
Yes, I too also loved the book. Yeah, it's just, oh God, it's the same feeling as reading like Meet Me in Yeah. Boston, where you're just like, oh, I'm just like, I'm getting all the gossip, but it's for like Steps and Liberty X Yeah. and Spice Girls and Five and S Club 7, and it really is so much fun. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, it's great. It's really, really good. I would recommend it to anyone.
And Michael is lovely. We had a great chat with him. So
yeah, I think anyone would get a thrill. Anyone who's alive will get a thrill out of this. If they were alive or a teenager in the 90s or 2000s, you'd really appreciate this.
Or the parent of a teenager in the 90s or the 2000s. Absolutely. You will have known all these songs, yeah. You know.
So we're going to chat to Michael shortly about the book and also to plug our friend Louise Bruton's Pop Emergencies Party, which Michael is coming over for. So Michael Craig is going to be interviewed by Louise on the Saturday 15th of July at Wigwam in Dublin at the Smash Hits Poll Winners Party, which is what the party is called. So an interview and Q&A with Michael Craig and a Y2K Pop Dance Party with Lou Brew. So tickets are on Eventbrite for that. That, if you want to buy tickets for it, which you should, it is on the show notes of this podcast as well. So go and hit that. And other than that, we are going to chat now to Michael Craig about pop music from the years 1996 to 2006.
It's their fifth week at number one, which makes them top of the pops. Here are the Spice Girls.
So we're joined by Michael Craig on this week's podcast. Michael just released a book called Reach for the Stars. And It explores pop UK pop music mostly from 1996 to 2006 and all through an oral history. I found it, I actually picked it up in the airport on the way to my holiday last month, and I found it a perfect holiday read. I kind of always say to myself, oh no, I won't read anything about music on my holidays, but that's exactly what I did. And it was very hard to put down. So thank you for that. So yeah, the book is an oral history about a lot of acts from 1996 to 2006. Can we start a little bit with, like, tell me why you decided to go with the oral history aspect of it?
Mainly because I wanted the people involved to tell the story themselves, because I felt like it was a time where they didn't really get to speak much. And if they did, it was often sort of quite frivolous questions about, you know, favorite color, favorite sandwich, filling or whatever, which is, you know, there's a place for that. But I did think, you know, with this sort of distance that we have now, that I'd like for them to sort of think back about that time, both the positives and the negatives. And I thought it would just be funny to use a format which tends to be quite serious and heavy. The oral history thing is sort of applied to, you know, The Wire or Radiohead or whatever. So I thought it'd be quite funny to put that into pop and have H from Steps next to sort of a critic, next to kind of, you know, Baby Spice or whatever. So I just imagine that would be quite funny. And obviously I made this big sort of proposal, and then I was like, God, what if no one agrees to do it? Because obviously I couldn't put them in the proposal because I hadn't done it yet. And I was like, oh, I'm sure I'll get loads of pop stars. And then I had a panic that I wouldn't get any, but I did in the end.
Yeah, you got quite a few.
How did you go about getting them? How was the
I sent a lot of emails. I mean, the good thing is a lot of these people are still together and they're still performing in one way or the other. So luckily, a lot of them still had sort of websites and PRs and managers that I could send these, not groveling emails, but I wanted to get across that the book is sort of honoring that music. It isn't coming at it from like a sort of, you know, negative way or me being sort of snobby about it. I really love the music, so I wanted to get that across. So I just sent, a lot of emails, and I did a lot of transcribing. There are like over 100 people in the book. So I listened to my voice and lots of voices for a very long time, and I never want to do that again.
Yeah.
As I was reading it, I was wondering, I was like, did each transcribe?
I couldn't let any of them like out of my sight. I got really like possessive about it, because obviously you can sort of get people to do it for you, or you can use those like transcription services, but I just couldn't handle the idea that something might happen to it. So I spent a lot of days, weeks and months transcribing.
Yeah, it's a lot. There's so much kind of like rich quotes in it. And I mean, so it starts with, obviously, where you should start when you talk about this period with the Spice Girls. And I mean, maybe you can tell us like why you decided to begin with the Spice Girls. Why were they the sort of the nexus of this period for you?
I guess because they kickstarted what sort of followed in terms of this kind of manufactured high gloss sort of pop that kind of swept through in their wake. And obviously they made so much money for record labels, so there was this huge amount of budget. So new pop bands were sort of bursting through like left, right and center. Like every month there'd be like a new boy band, girl band, mixed gender band. And Take That had just split up as well that same year. So sort of February 96, I think it was, or April, they sort of announced that they were splitting up in this quite sad sort of news conference thing where there was only four of them and they all looked a bit sort of tired and they had kind of long hair and terrible clothes. And you were like, oh, pop is sort of dead, you know, like, where's the fun gone? And then out of nowhere, of all things, a girl band at a time when everyone was being told that girl bands wouldn't work, with just these sort of five amazing women dressed as, you know, superheroes or whatever, with Wannabe, which sounded like nothing else, and sort of kickstarted this whole period. And so none of what followed would have happened, I don't think, without them, even in terms of like Simon Cowell rejecting them and then sort of trying to do a version of them later, or Chris Herbert, the manager, being sort of booted off and then going to do Five. So none of those things would have happened if Spice Girls hadn't come along. Thank God they did.
Yeah, what's so interesting with the Spice Girls as well, and they arrived at the right time because they were a little bit rough around the edges in terms of like performance, and you can see that in the Wannabe video, and the label apparently wanted to remake the video. But just how like they seemed to turn up into every room and just like overpower everyone and wanting to showcase how, like, just spontaneously singing to media or just turning up and like saying, I know you don't like us, but like you will like this kind of thing. Like it's so it's so effective and so brilliant how they just their combination, this five-headed monster, came in and just like took over in lots of ways.
Mm. And they had something to push against, because as you say, like, people didn't want them, you know. Smash Hits were not interested, even though they went into Smash Hits and like danced around the tables, but Smash Hits were moving into like an indie world, so they would rather have like the Blue Tones on the cover than the Spice Girls. And so I think Jerry especially and Mel B were like, okay, well, we're gonna make this work one way or the other. And obviously Smash Hits doing that meant that Top of the Pops could come along the magazine and give them the sort of famous nicknames and have them on the cover. And they were so successful that them being on the cover meant that Top of the Pops sold more than Smash Hits in the end. So they really like changed everything. And it's interesting actually, because they were rebellious, they did write on the songs, and so it's weird that they kickstarted what followed, which was much sort of more controlled. You know, people like S Club 7 were not like the Spice Girls in a way, but purely because they sort of attracted a younger fan base who wanted to spend lots of money on CDs and merchandise. They're sort of similar in that sense.
Yeah, I think it's easy to misread what is successful about the Spice Girls and look at them and say, oh, well, we just need something. We need a band where every little girl has somebody to aspire to or to relate to. But they were just so much more than that. They were gobby and rebellious, and like everything that you read about them and all the stories that are in the book about them, they just seem so like irritating to be around.
if
you were somebody who was like trying to get some work done at your record label, and here it's like, oh, here they come. And you know, I love the part in the book, I can't remember who says it, but that they were called Spice, but somebody kept calling them just, oh, those Spice Girls.
Yeah.
Which is almost this kind of like dismissive sort of derogatory way to refer to them. But then it becomes their identity. And they seem like absolute nightmares, but that is what made them so special. And like I rewatched the Wannabe video after reading the part in the book when more than one person said that it was an awful video, and I was like, that's not how I remember it. I was like, this is a masterpiece. What are people talking about? In like two continuous shots, like they're nailing their dance moves, you know, every like backing character in it is iconic. Like it's an amazing video. And it has a charm to it that I think it would be so easy to look at it and say, oh, it's cheap and it's, you know, it looks a bit rough around the edges and we can't sell this. But it's exactly that makes, that made me as a little girl love the Spice Girls, and girl power was going to change the world. And, you know, and it did in many ways. But yeah, I was mad that people were, you know, talking down that video. I was like, no.
Yeah, like they were going to reshoot it. You know, that nearly happened, but they just ran out of time because luckily they'd become sort of so popular, or the single was sort of building up. And yeah, I think it would have been a shame. I think the idea was it wasn't polished enough. You know, the label had spent a lot of money already to sort of get them. So I think they wanted it to look shiny. And of course, that wouldn't have worked with the song at all. And in the end, it was perfect. And, you know, Mel B sort of running off and just buying like a cheap top from like the shop because she didn't like the designer one that they gave her is sort of them. It's like, I don't want to wear this if I'm going to be uncomfortable, or do this if it's going to make me uncomfortable.
Yeah. And somebody that you spoke to referred to it as a punk song, and that just completely like opened my mind up to it in a whole different way. I was like, it is a punk song.
Biff Stannard, who wrote it with them, I think he said that. And you know, it did just sound unlike anything else, and really doesn't even sound like anything else they did after. You know, it could have only been like the first single, because you can't release that as like your third or whatever. It's never going to work.
And in terms of everything that came after the Spice Girls, I think it was interesting as well, the contrast there. They seem to have a lot of creative control. They were very headstrong in terms of in their business sense as well, in terms of management and who was working with them. And so that is something that maybe a lot of the other acts that you cover in the book didn't have. So interesting to note, like, it's kind of like the blueprint allows those things to happen. Then when it gets calcified afterwards, everything else is a bit like more controlled, and then therefore maybe a little bit less interesting in terms of like worldwide appeal and stuff like that. There are some great anecdotes in the book as well. The one about Russell Brand auditioning for Five, but and denying it ever since.
I am so tinfoil hat about that now. Like, I'd never heard that before. Yeah. And now I'm like, well, obviously he did.
Yeah, he definitely did.
Or come on. If he, especially if he's denying it.
Yeah.
Like,
well, yeah, exactly. Embrace that. It's hilarious. Yeah. But
I love all of the, anytime anybody was talking about like the beginnings of the bands, because it's just not something that we have now. Like the idea of reading an ad for, you know, we're looking for sassy 16 to 23 year olds to come down and audition. And was it for the Five auditions where it was just like a conveyor belt where they'd audition people like, you know, 10 boys at a time, and it's just, and they're like, can you dance, can you sing, what is your look? And the idea that that would happen now is just so, it feels like it's so much longer ago than it actually is, because of how removed we are from that kind of, from that being the norm in the industry. But it was completely normal in the 1990s to, and I suppose that's what was so appealing about pop in the 90s, is that you could just walk into an audition one day and your life would change.
Yeah. And I wanted to sort of capture that, like for them to talk about sort of what that process was like, what they were doing like the day before they went to that audition, how they even heard of the audition. You know, one of Five talks about sort of being hungover and his dad kind of forcing him to go to it. And the advert was like, we're looking for the Spice Boys, because it was Chris Herbert who sort of had done both. And he was like, I don't want to be a Spice Boy. But obviously going to that audition and getting through changed his life. And then you sort of want to know whether it changed his life for the good or for the bad, you know. I wanted to sort of get to that point of like, do you regret it? You know, was this period sort of as amazing as it seemed, or was it actually sort of tricky? And I think it was both for a lot of them.
That's something that echoes a lot in the book from a lot of people, is the specific details of how these young pop stars maybe don't know how to move through the world, whether it's like paying bills or laundry or anything to do with looking after yourself when you're thrown into a house in the middle of nowhere. Like Scott from Five saying the band, like they didn't know that it was their money, like most bands probably who are young who get a record deal these days, or in the last whenever number of years, keeping the meter running on a taxi for an hour while he has a sleep or gets changed, you know, those kind of things. But it is crazy, the schedules that they had, the ongoing treadmill of the schedules and nonstop, whether it's Bradley from S Club 7 being pulled out of the nightclub to record vocals at 2 a.m. I think it was the Atomic Kitten recordings where literally everything else is recorded and they're just running in because they have 15 minutes to go and like record the top line vocals or the main vocals over the, what, all the backtracks and everything else done by somebody else. There's Natasha from Atomic Kitten like saying she was back on stage dancing 6 weeks after having an emergency C-section, you know. These are things that now, and we've talked about on this podcast a lot about in the context of Britney and how people are treated and stuff like that. It's just those specific examples are really like, wow, these are very jarring to read again these years later when it's not actually that long. You know what I mean?
No, and the schedules were, I mean, you have to factor in that there were so many magazines, so many TV shows back then. You know, it's changed so much now. You would have to sort of, you had obviously a 6 week build up to your single coming out, so you had to do all of these things to tell people that it was coming. You know, you couldn't just fire off a tweet or go on TikTok or whatever. So the schedules were packed, and obviously the money was a lot back then. You know, Liberty X's third video from their second album was £250,000. Now that you don't get that for like your first comeback video necessarily. Yeah. So there was a lot of investment, a lot of kind of time and energy going in. But obviously you've also got these people who are very young. They don't really know what's going on necessarily in terms of how to live, how to like where the money's going, whether they have any money. You know, some of them were like, oh, we only got told that we'd got all this cash sort of 3 years in or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, I wanted them to talk about the mental health aspects and the sort of negativity without it being like the main story, but it's sort of, you know, it's only fair to ask them about those things now because they didn't have anyone to talk to about it at that time. Mental health wasn't really discussed in that way.
Yeah, and also not even recognized, you know, Sean from Five saying he left the band because he was struggling with anxiety and no one really recognizing that and, you know, taking the step to go to a counselor when, you know, people didn't do that and saying Simon Cowell was kind of annoyed with him for leaving the group.
Yeah, because there was this expectation and maybe we've only just started to get rid of that, which is, if you're in the public eye, you're living your best life. Like this has to be the sort of ultimate for anyone, is to be rich and famous. But I think the problem was, is A, they weren't rich, and B, they were famous, but it was very, you know, it could have been taken away at any time. And often it didn't last longer than sort of 5 years. And then you're always known as Lee from 911, for example. You know, he talks about that thing of like, one day going to the shops and not being in the band anymore and people still recognizing him, but knowing that they're not together anymore and that attention sort of being twisted into something sort of negative suddenly is a bit of a, you know, that's going to sort of play on anyone's mind, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love the focus in the book on how much of a role that gay fans and gay nights kind of played in a lot of this. Mm. Because I think when we talk about pop music from this time, it's easy to kind of focus on little girls being like supportive of it. But I think that, you know, like playing at GAY and being on the cover of like gay magazines, if you're a straight artist, like all of that aspect of it was really interesting. And it wasn't really something that I was aware of because I was a child at the time. So yeah, maybe if you could tell us like a little bit about like that side of it.
Yeah, and it's strange because obviously on the one hand you had people being told that they shouldn't come out if they were gay. It was like, okay, well, you know, that's fine, but don't tell anyone. Or that's fine, but like if anyone asks, just say you fancy Britney or Christina or whatever, because they were worried that would sort of destabilize the fan base and that young girls wouldn't fancy you if they knew that somehow they couldn't be your girlfriend. And so you had that on the one side, but then on the other you had, right, well, let's go and get the sort of pink pound and let's make sure that you're sort of at GAY, but obviously you're still straight or straight acting and you can sort of take your top off and you can be on the cover of gay magazines, because we hadn't got to the point where actually we should put gay people on the front of these magazines, or we should sort of elevate those voices. And so you did have sort of Jay from Five, or usually the drummer from McFly with his top off, you know, on the cover of these magazines, because they did sell. And it was a market that was sort of hugely worth breaking, because they, you know, the sort of money that could be spent on things, the sort of loyalty, the fact that you could kind of reach a different audience as well. I think for a lot of the pop stars, it was quite fun because you go to GAY and it was late, you could drink, you could sort of do a lot more on stage than you could in front of like the Smash Hits Paul Winners Party crowd. So it must have been difficult to sort of be a closeted gay pop star and sort of have these two things running parallel, where you're sort of in the closet, but also courting a sort of fan base of fellow gay people, but without kind of being able to talk about it. And obviously there were sort of exceptions to that. Will Young and obviously Stephen Gately later and Age From Step sort of later, but it wasn't often that you would be in a band at the peak of your success and sort of talk about being gay.
There's a sweet moment when H From Steps is remembering being asked who he fancies in an interview. And one of the girls just kind of says, oh, he only has eyes for me. And that there's this kind of like, there was this protective sort of shield around him, which I found really, really sweet, actually.
Yeah.
It's like that they were really minding him because of, and I suppose the girls in the group would have known that it's like they would have encountered difficulties kind of unique to being a female pop star, and that maybe would have, you know, made them aware that he will encounter difficulties that like none of us are aware of or equipped to deal with. And there's no, you know, there's no blueprint for this. We don't know how this would go. So yeah, I thought that was really sweet. And it's a funny thing to think of, because now it's like when you think of pop music, it's just, oh well, it's the girls and the gays. Like that's who it's for. But there was this sort of, you know, weird gray area in the 90s where you'd have to kind of try to market Five as like a laddish band, kind of to lads as well as girls.
Yes.
And it's like,
and also
really?
I think, you know, it's important to remember that the press was incredibly homophobic at that time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The George Michael example was important because his career, especially in America, did suffer when, you know, he sort of did come out in a very public way. But, you know, the way it was written about in the tabloids was awful. And so I think for anyone maybe thinking of doing it around that time or sort of building up to that would have seen that and been like, well, I don't, you know, I can't have that happen, or I can't risk the careers of my friends because this is what I'm being told will happen. And so there's a lot, there must have been a lot on people's shoulders of just like, let's just keep this quiet because I don't want to rock the boat, which is, you know, bringing joy to like people and also like helping my friends kind of have a career. That must have been a lot.
Yeah.
So you talked a lot to, you give a lot of space as well to the songwriters and producers of these songs as well, which is probably people who don't really get a chance to talk about this. I think that's one of the really interesting parts for me is just hearing, like you said, about, you know, the, is it Five that were given, were trying to get that. Hit Me Baby One More Time and then said in front of Max Martin, that's fucking wank. Those kind of things, you know, and like how songs are going to pass around and then eventually settle on others. And then Simon Cowell says he wants that he would give his Aston Martin for that song and it doesn't work out, and how some songs are work really well for others. Can you talk a little bit about Xenomania and how kind of they became what they were for Girls Aloud, because I think they were really important in terms of before that, the work that they did before that in terms of how they got there.
Yes, because Brian Higgins, who basically sort of runs Xenomania with a team of mad songwriters and producers, he had done Believe by Cher, which had obviously become hugely successful and made him a lot of money. But rather than sort of go with that and like, you know, he said no to a lot of things because he wanted to build this kind of factory of pop that would, he hated what was happening. He hated the Max Martin sound of this sort of Swedish kind of version of R&B. He hated the like pastiche of Steps and S Club 7. So he wanted to completely destroy all of that. And so the initial idea was to do this act called Moon Baby, which was Miranda Cooper, who ended up writing, who was part of Xenomania in the end and ended up writing a lot of the Girls Aloud songs. So he put all of his eggs in this basket and it wasn't working and it was sort of failing. And he had this other girl band called Orchid, and they recorded a song called Sound of the Underground, which Miranda had written with another songwriter. And he took it to the head of Polydor, and he was like, look, I love the song, but it's just not the right time for this. And so Brian was a bit like, what am I going to do? Because I've got this amazing song, but there's no vehicle for this. Like, we're, you know, fucked, basically. And then he got a call saying, I found it. And it's this TV show called Pop Stars The Rivals. And they're putting a girl band together. And this is going to be their first single, which is crazy because we'd already had like Pop Idol and Pop Stars. And you do not give a really good song. original song to the winners of those shows. You give them a ballad, you give them something quite dreary that isn't going to like rock the boat. And so all the girls who were in the final sort of 10 were played this song and they were like, what on earth is this? You know, it's sort of surf guitars and like drum and bass, and it's upbeat, which is also rare for them. So everyone hated it, or maybe not hated it, but was like very confused.
Something funny's going on inside. Now I'm running, don't know what is pushing me higher. It's
they went with it, which is amazing that Polydor would sort of do that, because it was either going to be that or Stay Another Day by E17, like, wow, a cover of that song. So that was a huge crossroads and a huge sort of risk that they took. And obviously Girls Aloud won, and the cover, the boy band did a cover of a Bee Gees song that no one even liked and came second, got to number two and were never really heard of again. And Girls Aloud obviously then got locked in by Xenomania, crucially, I think, from that moment on. And Xenomania just sort of worked all these sort of bizarre songs around them and had them come in and sing each line of each song five different times in five different keys, and each girl would sing them, and then they'd be like stitched together on a computer of like all these tracks, and Miranda would have like a book of lyrics rather than anything like on a computer, and she would just sort of sing them all. And I mean, it sounded like a complete nightmare, yeah, and they all sort of got severe headaches in the studio, but it worked because they weren't like anyone else. And I think at that point, anyone that sort of stood out from that manufactured, you know, by this point, that manufactured sound had become quite dated and everyone was really sick of the sort of TV talent show vibe. And so Girls Aloud and Sugar Babes, who did a lot of stuff with, yeah, them, stood out for that reason.
Yeah, definitely taking in influences from other like subgenres and stuff like that, and then bringing them in, yeah, and making them sound exciting, which was something that a lot of, especially the TV talent shows, didn't do.
No, and you obviously have had pop versus indie was a big thing then. You know, we don't have it, yeah, as much now. Like, pop is obviously written about in the way that rock music is, but it wasn't really then. And so you had this girl band from a TV talent show who were being reviewed by NME and given glowing reviews in like Observer, Music Monthly and The Guardian, and broadsheets were like, this is great. And so that allowed like musos to be like, I don't like pop music, but I do love Girls Aloud. And I don't, yeah, really like, yeah, the girls. I love Xenomania because they're like geniuses. And so you had that happening to the point where, and I didn't know this before the book, but to the point where the Girls Aloud Best Of that came out, the reason it doesn't have a picture of the girls on the cover is because they'd focus grouped people and they were like, look, we're not going to buy this CD if it's got like five pretty girls on it because it looks like a pop album, but we will buy it if it has a terrible graphic.
Yeah.
And they did, because it got to number one and it was their first number one album and it sold over a million copies.
Yeah. There was a couple of different flashpoints of pop versus indie in the book, covered like Belle and Sebastian at the Brits,
winning Best Newcomer over Steps. Section. Who the hell are Belle and Sebastian? Like, everyone just like, who?
I know, it was said about 12 times by...
Only the band Steps could have been. And then there's obviously the Rage Against the Machine campaign. By that point, we're talking, I can't remember the year exactly, but by that point we're kind of well over the talent show stuff, and so there was a lot of people making the point, it was like, oh, let's, the Christmas number one every year goes to whoever wins the X Factor, so Rage Against the Machine song against, was it Joe McKeldry?
Yeah, I think, poor Joe McKeldry.
Yeah, yeah.
So. Poor Joe. I don't think he was the right person to have that campaign.
And actually, he was sort of fine about it. I think out of everyone that had been on the X Factor that I spoke to, he is absolutely fine. You know, he was just like, look, I had a great time. I won. I did have the number one like the week after.
Yeah, he said it helped them sell records, maybe, ultimately.
Yeah, like they both sold loads. So I think, you know, I mean, it was cruel and it was a bit like, well, who are you really punishing? Because Simon Cowell ultimately doesn't care. I mean, he probably did care a bit, but, you know, a year later, One Direction came along and, you know, he doesn't care.
Yeah.
So Joe McKeldry is your sort of innocent victim in all of this. And obviously it built up slightly the year before with Alexandra Burke and Alleluia and, you know, Jeff Buckley and Leonard Cohen fans getting their knickers in a twist. But she had ultimately won by quite a big margin, but I think Joe sort of suffered, you know, as you say, like this sort of pushback from people just being a bit sick of knowing exactly who was going to get it and it just be a cover.
Yeah. And then what would happen in the X Factor every year is, you know, like the singers were dropped increasingly quicker. If you're living in a landscape where And this is throughout the whole book, really, is if you get a number two or a number three, you're like, you're nearly finished. That's it. And yeah, that's kind of an insane level to work towards or to adhere to in a working relationship, in a day-to-day working relationship. Your job is like, if you don't get number one, this is it now. You're probably going to be dropped. So that kind of reaches its kind of nadir when you get to the X Factor and people are quickly dropped or not, and then ultimately not even offered albums to release. An album deal. You think it's Steve
Brookstein? I think that's the sad thing.
Yeah. Steve Brookstein said he was offered £12,500 from his £1 million contract ultimately. And you see that repeatedly over and over again where, you know, these people who just don't really last the test of time, and ultimately it becomes this. The narrative becomes whoever comes second is or third is probably better off because they have time to develop their career. And then you get like you winners like Matt Cardle instead of One Direction, which is later than the book, but you know, it just shows you what comes next in terms of pop music is like this return to.
You would think of how much pussy he's going to get.
Exactly. That famous Harry Styles moment. Best doesn't talk about that anymore, does he?
No. I was at his show in Slane and my friend like shouted that in my ear during one of the songs. I was like, where did that come from? Just like the annals of your memory.
I know. It was amazing. But that was a time when everyone would watch The X Factor and everyone was sort of on Twitter and it was like the biggest show. And obviously...
Yeah.
It was huge, but it did mean the conveyor belt was, if you won, you might only have that year until the next load of people come through. And obviously, if you don't immediately hit it out the park, you're in trouble. And obviously, in order to do that, they're spending a lot of money to get the biggest songwriters. Like I think especially after Leona with Bleeding Love, and it was sort of the biggest selling single in America and number one in America. And so then Ryan Tedder, who wrote that, you know, he's not cheap. So in order for like Alexandra Burke to come along after and trying to compete with that, and, you know, Red One did a lot of stuff on that album and Neo and all these big people, but it didn't sell in that way. And so you'd rather be JLS who came second and were able to sort of go and work on a different label and think about what they wanted and who they were. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you're getting to a position where you don't want to win, which is weird for a TV talent show competition.
I've always thought that the X Factor should be like the Olympics, where it's every 4 years.
Yeah.
Just have a chance.
Especially by the end, because fans were like, well, why am I going to invest in the winner of the show if history is telling me that by next year they'll be gone? And then it's also now telling me that they're not going to release an album even. So why am I going to invest in anything to do with this person? Because I'm not even going to be able to hear them singing ever again, really. Yeah. And even at the peak of like going back in time, you had bands like All Stars and V. They would release albums, even though they only got to like number 40, whatever, or 80, whatever. They would at least be given an album. So there would be this sort of product for people who did like them to enjoy. And then weirdly, by the time The X Factor came along, those last sort of two or three winners didn't even get an album out, which I think sort of killed it off, really.
Yeah.
And when we talk about the TV talent shows, especially, I mean, it's kind of a reality TV, the machinations of making reality TV. There's some interesting insight into how the members were treated in terms of, you know, how they were worn down over hours in interviews and asked about whatever negative thing they said in their initial application form before they... to the point where they start crying about it or and then they use that in the show, or how they were given a bait and switch and or you know, withheld time or resources or songs or information in order to put them on the edge so that they would kind of look set up to fail, essentially. So, and then it's obviously that famous Kim Marsh of Hearsay being told by Nasty Nigel that the goose has gotten fat. Like, this was normal Saturday night entertainment at this time. So it's kind of interesting to go back. It wasn't that long ago. So when it comes to like the media landscape overall, like there's a lot of, we talk a bit about the importance of say CDUK and Pop World and Smash Hits and Top of the Pops, because these are institutions which no longer really are here for us anymore. So how important were they then and why are they not there now?
Well, yes. And that's why the book ends in 2006, sort of. I mean, I do go into Joe McElderry because between you and I had already done the interview when I decided to move the date to 2006, and I wanted to keep him in. But anyway, so 2006 is when Smash Hits closed, Top of the Pops finished, Pop World, Simon and Makita left Pop World, CD UK ended, and I think...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
That just felt like a perfect end of this period because, as you say, like these shows and magazines were so sort of important. They played like such a vital role in telling fans what was coming out, performing the songs every week on Top of the Pops, selling albums, selling like the personality of the band, merch, all of that sort of stuff. So they were vitally important. And then obviously the internet happened. You know, you didn't need to buy magazines in the same way that you did before. Big Brother happened, which I think is important. Reality TV happened. You know, someone in the book sort of says that Friday night Big Brother was almost like Top of the Pops. You know, you were watching this sort of frenzied crowd with like dance music and like a host, and then a winner was sort of proclaimed and a loser and all of this sort of stuff. So that was all happening. And I think, you know, it was interesting to hear that Smash Hits by the end was covering TV actors, you know, Hollyoaks people and Skins or whatever, more than it was pop stars, because there weren't that many pop stars by that point. You know, Sugar Babes, Girls Aloud, Busted, McFly later on, but they were, that was it. Outside of the X Factor, they were the only ones that were sort of still around, because the X Factor had also sort of gobbled up A&R and label time and label money. You know, you sort of knew that you would have this conveyor belt of new people coming along that you could sign, and half the job was done for you because they've been on TV for 10 weeks.
Yeah.
It's not like anyone's going to be like, oh, we need to work out how to launch Cher Lloyd. It's like, well, she has a fan base already. So all those things together meant that it all sort of collapsed. And I think also I couldn't get into the world of MySpace and Lily Allen because it felt so different. And she started in 2006 as well. And her type of pop star was so different, you know.
Yeah.
Sort of more credible. Mm. She's writing about her own experiences. She's writing about, you know, very sort of really zooming in on like life, whereas the other stuff was huge, like generalities, like Reach for the Stars, Climb Every Mountain Higher. Lily Allen is not going to sing that. So it just felt like pop had shifted as well at that point. People wanted more. You could reach out to pop stars on Twitter, and I think they wanted that sort of reflected in their pop stars at that point.
Yeah, and you also attribute the allowance of downloads on the singles charts as one of the factors perhaps of you know, the importance of the singles charts in general, and obviously Top of the Pops.
Yeah, and they just got more confusing, I think. You know, ultimately, like, it was, you know, thing you could downloads counted if it was the second week or the first week, or like only if there was an actual CD, and then they did away with that, and then you kind of have obviously streaming coming in later. But I think the decline in sort of people's caring about charts in that way, or really understanding them, sort of started to happen in this period as well, which is a shame because I love charts, but I don't understand really how they work anymore.
Yeah, I used to check the charts all the time. I used to check them on the teletext. And now, if you ask me who was number one right now, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, like, I used to record them on tape.
No idea.
Yeah. We had a show called Top 30 Hits on Irish TV, which was our own little version of Top of the Pops. It was like nothing, it was just music videos. But
we just play the music videos. Though,
sometimes not even the music videos. It was like the lyric video that someone had made up for it because the song didn't have
lyric
one,
videos, yeah, if we couldn't get the rights, yeah.
Or just didn't exist mostly. It was great because it was top 30, so like they had to play a video for every song. So they just had this like rotating graphic for whatever song was at number 30, you know?
Yeah, they were good days.
Yeah, you'd really get a pulse of a nation or a cultural nation anyway. And I think now obviously things have fractured and the gatekeepers as such aren't really there anymore in the same way. And you can kind of see what you're saying there about, you know, the people that were being written about by those magazines are, it's like the early influencers. They're like, they're not pop stars. They're not being written about for being for their artistry or their creativity. They're being written about for their notoriety. So Michael, what was your relationship with pop music at this period? What were you up to?
Well, so this is where it all I reveal my secrets, is because I was slightly like older than, you know, like when the Spice Girls first came out, I was sort of 14. And so I was starting to be like, I liked the Spice Girls, obviously. And I had really liked Michael Jackson before. Like, he was my sort of childhood pop star. So I loved pop music and I loved the sort of performance of it. But as I got older in this period, I was a bit like, I'm a bit cooler than this, guys. So like when I went to university, I was like, I'm really into Radiohead. And which I sort of was, but I was sort of hiding a lot of stuff. And so to sort of reveal myself as like a pop fan, I wasn't really like at that point in my life. So it wasn't until a bit later where I was like, right, I just don't really care anymore. You know, when you're a teenager, you're a bit like, you know, I have to like sort of, or I thought I had to like what was cool at that time. And I obviously sort of knew that this particular type of pop wasn't. And so actually doing the book was quite nice. It was like really sort of going back to that period and sort of letting myself enjoy it. And I'd really got into it in lockdown again, just sort of listening to how brilliant the songs are. You know, even if the pop stars weren't great, the songs were great in some instances. And, you know, there were terrible songs as well, obviously. And there were terrible pop stars, as there always have been and always will be. But I just sort of loved kind of listening to them again. And that's sort of where the idea came from, was to sort of do that. But yeah, at the time I loved like Girls Aloud and Sugar Babes, and I loved, you know, Don't Stop Moving and all of that. But I wasn't like an avid kind of super fan of any particular band.
Was there any music of the period that you have a new appreciation for? And similarly, was there any which you feel is maybe quite dated now that you loved at the time or?
Well, I think a lot of it doesn't sound dated, which is great, because I mean, there was a period where I thought, is the sort of Xenomania stuff so specifically of this period that it almost sounds dated? Even though it's sort of the most experimental and weird, it sort of became, I don't know, that was my only danger. But actually, when I was doing the book, I listened to them constantly and was like, this is absolutely mad and brilliant and I love it. And so I don't think that's going to happen. I actually think the 5 singles are great.
Yeah,
you know, like I had sort of dismissed them slightly as just kind of not being great, and you sort of forget how big they were and how they almost did sort of have this big breakthrough in America, which would have set them up as like a kind of Backstreet Boys style huge global band if they weren't just so terrible at like being in each other's company. And you know, if they'd had any media training, maybe they would have been okay. So I'm surprised pleasantly at how much I enjoyed sort of listening to, because when I put each chapter together, I only listened to that band's like discography, and I was very happy to listen to 5 all day long.
Yeah, my little sister was a fan of 5 at the time, so I wasn't going to be listening to them. But, you know, going back and revisiting when I was reading it, I was like, God, yeah, they actually weren't bad. Like,
yeah,
some great shoes there.
Yeah. And also they did have, you know, this was the period of Max Martin started in this period. Yeah. You know, Stargate did a lot of this stuff for like Mystique and, you know, all these huge producers who are still working in pop, like Steve Mack, who does a lot of Ed Sheeran stuff, did the Westlife stuff. So we're talking about really brilliant people who know what they're doing, who are sort of hugely successful now. So even when the pop stars maybe weren't up to scratch, the songs were very good.
Obviously, there's a lot of coverage of the Svengalis of the time. Do you think they are even around in the same way anymore? Do you like how, what do you think the machinations of pop music are like now? That are those obviously Louis Walsh is still knocking around here and there. As you
Louis know. Walsh is still knocking around, my dear friend. The quote that's on the book is something that he said to me at the start of our interview. So I was incredibly happy about that.
And that was no one's going to read this book.
No one's going to read this book. Who cares?
God.
Brutal. Louis, but also funny. Like, I thought it was funny.
It's so him, so though. Funny. It's just so him.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know.
Everything he said, like, reads like Louis Walsh, which is kind of what I wanted. Yeah. But
everything that I read, every one of his bits I read in his voice.
Yeah, like, exactly.
It's so Louis. No matter what he's doing, he's so Louis.
Yeah.
Like, it's so funny.
I think it's interesting that, you know, Simon Cowell apparently has sort of gone back into doing A&R and Louis is putting together a boy band or has put together a boy band. So I thought it was quite interesting that a lot of these big players have sort of gone back to doing what they did before they became famous on TV, which I think is a sort of interesting thing to have happened. I don't think they can be as big as they were then, obviously, because the TV show isn't really happening. And I don't know that there are these sort of figures in that same way who are so tapped into what's going on in the general public, because that's hard to know now. Like, this sort of monoculture thing that we had doesn't exist. So a lot of people talked in the book about how good Simon and Louis were at knowing what sort of Debbie and Dave in Blackpool want to listen to, which is not something that a lot of people cared about necessarily at that time. It was very like London, you know, or it was very like cool, like how do we get the cool guys, or how do we get Radio One? And they were like, well, who cares about Radio One, or who cares about whether Q magazine are going to review Westlife? It doesn't matter. Like, we want to get to these people who are going to buy this in Tesco and listen to it in their car and come and see them in the show. Like, let's just do that. And obviously a brilliant way of doing that is just to get them to do covers of songs that they hear on Magic FM.
They already know.
Because we can just do that. And obviously Louis is absolutely adamant that that was all his doing, but I'm sure Simon has something to say about that.
Yeah.
Was there anyone who, because you interviewed like some like very, very iconic people for the book, was there anyone who like, or who was the person that when you were getting ready to interview them, you were thinking most like, oh God, I hope they're nice. I hope they're as nice as I want them to be.
I really wanted to interview Mucha from the Sugar Babes, which obviously did happen. And I was slightly worried that maybe she would just sort of be a bit bored of doing it, or like not really sort of want to go back to this period necessarily. She just seems like someone who sort of doesn't take any shit from anyone. So, but actually we spoke for like an hour and she was great. And she sort of, you know, did go into a lot of stuff about why she left the band and sort of the solo kind of career that she had that kind of came to an end. So she was great, but I was nervous about her. And I was nervous about Pete Waterman because I was just given his phone number by someone. So I just texted him being like, hey, Pete, and had to explain everything in like this mad text message. And then he was just like, oh, call me now. And I was like, what? I haven't done any questions.
No.
So I just called him and he was like in his garden, just like pottering around the garden. And then he was like, oh, I've got to go, but let's, you know, do it again later. And then I forgot to ask him about Steps versus Belle and Sebastian because I hadn't written down any questions. So then I had to text him, you know, 2 days later being like, look, I'm really sorry. Can I speak to you again? And he was like, yeah, I'm just on the train. Like, text me and like, call me in an hour or whatever. Okay. So that was all quite stressful because I knew he was so important and I didn't not want him in it. And I also didn't want to like piss him off by texting him and out of the blue, which I did. Same with Louis. Yeah. I got given Louis's phone number and I just texted him, which, I mean, it sounds mad now, but I was very like, I was on a roll at that point. Yeah. I don't know if I would do that now, but I just texted him and explained everything and he didn't reply for ages. And then he did. And then he said, I'll give you 10 minutes.
Oh.
So that's all I had. Yeah, that's all I had with Louis was 10 minutes.
And did you try and get contact with Simon?
I did. I tried Simon Fuller and Simon Cowell, but I did not get a reply.
No.
Yeah.
Just like stone, like nothing.
Yeah. And I was firing off so many emails that at a certain point I you know, it wasn't until later on that I was like, they never got back to me, but of course they didn't. And yeah. I did try a couple of times. And there was, you know, there were people who I wanted that I couldn't get. And so I just sort of reshaped the book around obviously who I could get and sort of figured it out as I went along. Mm. But I'm happy, you know, I got 100 and something people, so I'm happy with that. But I would have liked, you know, yeah. Will Young and Gareth Gates, I really wanted, but for one reason or another, that didn't happen.
Yeah. So, Michael, where do you think pop music is at now in 2023 compared to that period? Like, what would you, if you were toplining the pop music at the moment compared to this period in 20 years' time, where would you start, do you think?
Well, songs are shorter now, which I'm annoyed about because I like a 3:30 song. There are no middle eights, which I'm annoyed about because I like a middle eight. There are definitely fewer key changes, which, you know, I'm on the fence about that. I like them. But and also, I think there was a period where everything was obviously darker lyrically. You know, Billie Eilish is sort of one of the biggest pop stars, and I don't think that would have happened. Well, she probably wouldn't have even been classed as pop back then. It was very much like delineated a bit more, you know, like this is pop or this is a specific kind of pop. And I don't think that exists now. But I think post-pandemic, post sort of lockdown, I hope people are being a bit more fun again now. I think people sort of got very much like in their feelings and very sort of, we need a sort of escapism. And I'm hopeful that that is potentially sort of coming back now. You know, you have sort of Dua Lipa and, you know, hopefully like that kind of, you know, the Charlie XCX's and the Dua Lipa's and the sort of, what was the song that I heard the other day that just felt sort of very kind of, you know, Olivia Rodrigo, for example. I mean, those songs are still sort of not exactly like up and they're sort of railing against stuff, but they're sort of fun and, you know, the presentation of it is fun and it's sort of vibrant and interesting. And I hope we're going to have a bit more of that because we need that because it's so depressing. So depressing in this world generally that, you know, you want either like, I don't necessarily think we need that reflected back at us through our pop music. Yeah. So hopefully people will be like, let's just...
It needs some escapism. More escapism.
And that's probably why people have gone back to this period, because it was shiny and bright and ridiculous. And like, you know, the fashion was bonkers and everyone looked great / awful. I think, you know, we need a bit more of that.
Yeah, as well as the book, Michael, Reach for the Stars, which you can get in all good bookshops and bad bookshops, perhaps, as well. You're also here in Dublin on Saturday, July 15th for the Smash Hits Poll Winners Party, which is Pop Emergencies. Our friend Lou Brew, who's been on the podcast before, you'll be chatting with her about the book and music of the time. And Lou will be doing a Y2K pop dance party. So... you can get tickets for that on Eventbrite as well. So yeah, I hope you have a good time in Dublin and maybe we'll see you there. And and thanks you so much for writing the book. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me.
It's great. Great, we loved it.
Time is laying heavy on my heart. Seems I've got too much of it.
Thank you to Michael Craig for appearing on the podcast this week. Really appreciate it. Lovely to chat to him. As I said, Saturday 15th of July in Wigwam. Go and see Michael in the flesh, talking about his book, Reach for the Stars. And get a copy of the book. It's absolutely brilliant. I'm holding it in my hands right now. 500 pages of a very engaging oral history And go see DJ Lubrew as well on Saturday, July 15th as well. Now, if you're like us and you have to live a life, then you will appreciate that sometimes people have to pay for things in their lives. And that means patreon.com/909 is how sometimes we have to pay for stuff that we do associated with the website and the podcast. So patreon.com/909, you'd be directly supporting independent publication and podcaster and ourselves here. So patreon.com/909, there's a Discord access and all sorts of stuff happening. People talking about all sorts of stuff this week, including whatever's going on with the Taylor Swift tickets at the moment, which I'm still a bit confused by. I don't really know. You got tickets, Andrea, did you? Or you got an email to say you possibly might have tickets?
No, I got an email to say that I will be sent a link to be in with a chance to purchase a ticket. So it's very exciting over here. No word on how much the tickets cost. So I don't know, man. Like, I'll try, yeah. But
it's
who knows? Who knows if me and Swifty will be united? I'm gonna wear my I Hate Maddie Healy t-shirt anyway to the show. Just yeah. So everyone knows which
it's pretty
side of
impressive
the
number of steps or hoops you have to jump through in order to get just a ticket. She's just announced another a third gig in Dublin as well, which means she won't be doing Glastonbury next year because the same dates as Glastonbury completely. Yeah. So presumably you're going to get some sort of GPS code to a secret location, whereupon you must dig up an ancient Ohmstone and decipher its runes in order to get the final ticket link. I think that's what's going to happen next. Yeah. You have to ring up Louis Walsh and find
and
solve the riddle, whatever happens. Yeah.
Oh, Louis. Yeah. So hopefully we'll see. I don't know. I'm not, as we know, we all know of my complicated relationship with Ms. Swift.
Good.
But I'd like to see her live. I've never seen her live.
I went to see Khalees last night in the Guinness Storehouse, and just telling Michael there at the end of our chat that it was one of those PAs. I hadn't seen him for quite a while. It's really an American thing. I don't think acts outside of America really do it. It's like, you know, like it was obviously a Guinness sponsored event, and a lot of times when acts do that, American acts do it, they do like a quick 30-minute PA. The last time I think I saw somebody do it was Azealia Banks in 2012, where it's like, here's 30 minutes of all of my hits rammed into each other as quickly as possible so you can sing along to them all, a verse and a chorus each, and just like, this is it. This is it.
Amazing.
It was really fun though, because it was actually 10:30 by the time she came on stage, and our previous podcast guest, C'est la vie de moi, was there playing as well with a full band and Zappo. So that was cool. Nice to see. Are you going to Lana Del Rey this week? You're not, are you?
No. I like Lana's albums. I'm not.
Yeah, I kind of get the same impression. To be honest, I don't know if it could be too. I know people there obviously absolutely love her, but for me, I'm like, I could dip in.
Yeah, and I think she's very talented. But like, I watched her Glastonbury set, and I was like, I could take or leave this, you know, as a live experience. But I hope everyone who is going has a lovely time. It must be the shortest turnaround.
It was 10 days fully, 9-10 days basically.
In history.
So yeah, pretty mad. Mm. Pretty mad. And
it's kind of insane.
A couple of other things worth mentioning. Happy 50th birthday to Roisin Murphy. That woman, I put a video on Instagram last week from the gig I went to in Trinity College, and I just happened to capture the bit where she was doing her cool dancing, and I was like, she's so effortlessly cool. How do you do it? Like, so cool.
So cool.
a very fun gig as well. So
I
would recommend
so
digging into a playlist I put up on the website this week. Best of playlist, a personal best of playlist from Roisin Murphy. In adding to our recent discussion as well about festivals, and specifically Beyond the Pale at Body and Soul, both of them now have announced their dates for 2022. Four, and they've kind of swapped around the weekend. So Beyond the Pale is going on the later weekend, so the 21st to the 23rd, and Body and Soul is going from June 14th to 16th. So that solves that issue, at least. They're on a different time And one other thing I wanted to shout out as well is a news story I put up today about three bands who are playing 32 gigs in all 32 counties on the All-Ireland Tour. Isaac Jones, Henry Ernest and Passersby from August 15th to September 15th are doing a county a day, playing a gig in every county. So you can have a look at that. It's called the All-Ireland Tour of all of Ireland. So they'll be having various guests with them. So it kicks off on August 15th in Wicklow, going around every county all the way back to Dublin on the 15th of September. So yeah, there's ticket links up there soon for all that. So there's lots of interesting things happening as ever. There's loads of different small festivals and things announced in the recent weeks. So have a look at the news and festival section on the website. Andrea, anything to add?
I won't be here next week. I'll be away. So
great.
I'll see you.
We haven't discussed that. That means I'd forgotten. but that's okay. Listen, it's still summer. Yes. It's still summer. Did I know you're away? I did know you're away. I have in
easy
caps
breezy,
here,
baby.
Andrea away. Fair play to me.
You did.
We did. I just forgot.
But yeah. We'll all get a 99 next week. Summer, it's easy breezy. Who knows? Maybe
I'll just come on and talk about something.
His own thing.
Yeah, we'll see. That's it for episode 220 of the 909 podcast. We're keeping it short and sweet and all about fun pop music from 1996 to 2006. If you like what you heard on this podcast, I think you may enjoy other podcast episodes that we did about the Britney Spears documentary. We also had a chat with Jen Gannon about Spice yes. Girls and pop music around that time as well. Well worth delving into. Anyway, that's a self plug. And that's it from us. Thanks for listening. If you want to support us, as I said, it's patreon.com/909 and indeed any independent podcaster that you like, do consider supporting them if you can. And sign up to their Substack, maybe somebody like Andrea Cleary's Substack or her Ghost newsletter. Ghost.io, isn't it?
My Ghost. Yes. Andrea-Cleary.ghost.io. I will have some recommended books for paid subscribers soon and free subscribers.
Great. All right.
Stuff there for you.
Thanks, Emil. Talk to you next week.
Yeah.
Shout out to everyone in the Discord and bye.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA.
TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.